Hello, world. This is Allison Pipitone. In this podcast, we talk about music and those of us who do it for a song. Welcome to The Great Unsung. I want to start this episode by saying thank you. Thank you to all of you who've been emailing us, messaging us on Facebook and Twitter with your feedback, your suggestions, and your encouragement. Because kind of like the tree falling in the forest, if I recorded this podcast, beamed it out into the universe, and nobody listened, would it exist? I'm not sure. But if you know the answer to that question, please write it along with your name, on the back of a Bitcoin, and send it care of Allison Pipitone to thegreatunsung@gmail.com. Okay, in this episode, I spoke with George Schwint, who is the former drummer for Flogging Molly. I would highly recommend that you go on YouTube and search George Schwint, S-C-H-W-I-N-D-T, drummer, and check him out. Because holy macanoli can this guy play. He studied music at Ohio State. He toured and recorded for 20 years with Flogging Molly. And, let me put it to you this way, one of his mentors and drum teachers was Ed, the Tonight Show band Shaughnessy. Just take a minute and let that sink in. Okay, did it sink in? Well, my brother Damon is friends with George, so I dragged my newly engaged friend Shannon away from her romantic California vacation to help me set up the laptop and microphones in order to spend some quality time with George. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the multi-sensory experience of my interview with George Schwint for our latest episode of The Great Unsung. George, can I just call you Gorge?
No.
Okay. Hi, George. Thank you for being on my podcast.
You're welcome.
Did you know we're sitting outside a beautiful cafe in South Pasadena?
Yes, Nicole's Market.
Oh, yeah, Nicole's Market, and the beautiful piano music is playing behind us.
I can hear that.
Buses are going by. A car alarm just went off. We wanted to give people the real Los Angeles experience, right?
That's pretty close.
Yep. I have a bunch of questions for you, so let's just start.
Okay.
Okay. I was reading a little bit about you, and I know when you were maybe after college or just after college or before or during, you went to London for like a year. Is that true?
Yeah, that was after university.
After university. And you worked there for about a year, right? You worked there for...
I tried to work there.
Yes.
As much as I could, being an illegal alien.
Okay. And so the question I want to get to is this idea of saying yes to opportunity. And I feel like you're a guy who says yes to your opportunities. And do you know a lot of people don't do that because they're scared, right? And they're afraid of, say, failure. Or like, what in you says yes to opportunity?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't know where the if I recognize the opportunity all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I generate it for myself when it doesn't seem like there's an opportunity.
Okay. For example, can you give me what about the London thing? Let's talk about that. How did that come up?
Well, London was just an opportunity to go over there. And I had friends there at Virgin Records at the time. And so I just went and made friends and met an engineer and a producer and got to do some studio work. And did what I could when I was there, you know.
Can you read music?
Yes.
So, and studio work, what genre of music was that? Do you remember?
Oh, it was just pop or whatever. I was going in the middle of the night and fixing parts.
Really?
I was the invisible guy.
A lot of the people who listen to this podcast are students and people who want to be musicians or are starting their careers. So if you don't want to share anything I ask you, that's fine. But I'm curious. London, studio musician, fixing parts. How much do you get paid for something like that?
Back then it was maybe 50 pounds or something each time I went into a session. Mm-hmm. A lot of times it was just percussion. It wasn't even drums. And it was adding or going over parts that they weren't happy with. And it was only really through meeting people there. It wasn't like, hey, you're an amazing drummer, come to London to do it. It was just, I just went, mm-hmm. you know. I hung out at a drum shop that was near where I was staying in Archway on the northwest side. And there was an old drum shop, I don't think it's there anymore, at the bottom of Highgate Hill. And just started meeting people and through my friends at Virgin Records. You know, I met other musicians mm-hmm. and, like I said, this engineer, Martin Astle, and producer, and he invited me to come in and do some work. I mean, it didn't sustain itself.
Right.
Otherwise, I probably would have stayed longer.
Well, I think there's 0% chance it would have sustained itself if you didn't go, right?
Right. I mean, the friends that I made to this day are still there, and I still, when I can, do music with them and stay in touch with them. So that's great. It was expanding your world, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, that sort of brings me to my next topic. I'm skipping around a little bit, but Europe. In an interview, you talked about how you noticed that people in, you mentioned Russia, Brazil, and you said you were worried about when you guys were there that how would they like our music? And you had the observation that people in different countries, even in places that don't maybe speak English, they were super open to new music, right?
Right.
That experience. And can we generalize? Can you speak to Americans? Are Americans open to new music and new things like that?
I think they are, but not in the same context. As, for example, in Europe, you would see combinations at festivals of different kinds of music and band, one after the other, with 40, 50, 60,000 people in front of you that you would never see in the States. No promoter could put it together and sell tickets. Maybe now, that was whatever, you know, 5, 10 years ago. And then you say, oh, it works over there because I think people are more, again, generalizing, but if they're selling tickets and they're putting on the Roots and the White Stripes and all on the same stage, one after another, it's like, how did, you know, it's like you wouldn't think it, and it sells tickets and people were into it and they were open to it, mm-hmm. you know, and it's like, okay, that's cool, you know.
We have some concerts, 10,000 people, let's say, in Buffalo. They're like the Canal Side series, right, Shannon? And it used to be Thursday at the Square. And what I noticed, we were lucky enough to play it a bunch of times. I think you might have played something like that at one point. But what I always noticed is this, like some people in the front, maybe literally 5 or 10%, are super into listening to the music. And if they don't know you, they're open to you. Mm-hmm. But 80% of the people talking to their friends, drinking the beer, texting on their phones, like just they're at the event, but they're not
present,
yeah,
to what's going on. And you know, when in different musical things that I've been in, it's sometimes you just you overwhelm them with volume so they can't talk. Right. You just play so loud that, you know, it's ridiculous. You don't give them a chance. But the, you know, the whole experience of playing to a crowd where you don't see faces, you see the phone first, then the face, because it's always something between. They're not present. I mean,
phone, then face. That's something, isn't it?
Yeah, it's it's people like, and I don't, you know, this is what I've heard is that Jack White now at any show he plays, you check your phones. You check them in before you come in. No phones in there. They don't even realize that it takes away from a potential experience if they don't have any other experience of always being on their phone. So these kids, they don't know any different. They think that's what it's supposed to feel like, and they're not present to the stuff that's going on. And I think that's I don't mind like Jack White doing that. I think it's fine.
Not to mention the fact that when somebody does film a part of a concert, do you ever want to see it? They're like, hey, I was at the Elton John concert last night. Do you want to? Here, check it out. And they play it. You're like, okay. Like, you could see.
It looks like shit. It sounds like shit. Don't show me that stuff.
And plus, it wasted your whole concert. Just be there in that moment.
Right, exact. Be there in the moment.
I've had this conversation, and I know I do come off as old-fashioned. By the way, we're outside, and I told George, we don't care what noise comes by, but so far we've had so many. Here comes a bus. There's a train. We had the car alarm, but I think it's good because everyone's going to feel like they were here with us. The only problem is now I forget what I was talking about. Shannon, do you remember?
Yes, we were talking about phones.
Oh, phones. Okay, so thank you. I feel like a curmudgeon, but I feel like what they're missing is this. X number of people at this one place in this one city on this one night. You're the only people that are there. It's an experience, and this is the only time in history this is going to happen. So let's enjoy this moment, right? And I miss that. Like,
it's even from sitting in the drumming chair, I always felt like, you know, you're communicating with the people you see, the people you don't see. Like, And to have something between you and the person you're trying to communicate musically with, whether you have a microphone or not, it makes it all the more difficult to bring them in, right?
Mm-hmm.
To bring them into that feeling, that present moment sort of thing. It can happen.
Yeah, it's
when
a downward.
It happens, it's great.
Yes, and because they give it back to you, and then it just grows. It's like a spiral, right?
Right.
I'll keep an eye on that fly. If I slap you in the head, it's just because I'll get the fly away from you, okay?
I don't mind the flies. It's the mosquitoes.
I didn't know they had flies in Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah.
I know that sounds pretty dumb. Yeah, there was one on our plane. Maybe this is the only fly in California.
No, they have flies. They traveled with you. Just brought a fly. It's going to destroy the whole ecosystem. Thank you.
You know what? I'm really happy I got you to laugh because that was one of my goals because I love your laugh. I'm going to try it again and see if I can get you a real honest laugh.
All right. Good luck with that.
It's a challenge. See, even the volume of the piano is ramping up because it's building the drama. Okay, wait. Okay, here's one for you. Overcoming obstacles. I do think you saying yes to opportunity is one of the reasons that your life has been so fulfilling. I don't know if you personally feel like it is, but you have done a lot of amazing things that it's a good life, in my opinion, not knowing you that well, but reading a lot about you. Okay. So one of them is the saying yes to opportunities. And I a lot of what I approach this is because my own frame of reference, I feel like I've said no to things out of fear sometimes, mm-hmm. and I miss opportunities. So I respect in you the fact that you go for it and must come natural to you because you... Okay, so we'll move on from that topic.
Okay.
Topic one. Topic two, overcoming obstacles. Here's what I want to say. You played with Flogging Molly for like 20 years or something?
Yeah, 20 years.
Okay, so what I read is in the beginning, right when you auditioned and you got in their band 20 years ago, you had a problem with your thumb, right? And you had to get thumb surgery.
Right.
So at that moment, I mean, first of all, was it a big deal?
We pushed back the recording of the first studio record with Steve Albini, the first, turned out to be our debut studio record, Swagger, pushed back a week in the studio because my thumb wasn't in shape to do anything.
That's kind of a big deal. Pushing
it's
back a date with Steve Albini, right? Like,
yeah.
That's kind of a big deal.
Yeah. And then I didn't use My thumb was in a splint during the whole session. I didn't use my thumb. I put the stick in a different place.
Yep. And that's a big thing. That's a big adjustment.
It's a weird thing to do. You get new calluses in places you didn't think you could have calluses in.
Looking back and listening to that album, do you hear any difference in your playing because of that?
I think that album was just excitement and energy because just unbridled energy being in the studio with him and putting something down in a proper way for the first time. I think everybody's playing got better over time, and you know, better listening, better playing. But it was so, you didn't have a lot of time to analyze. We only had the money for, what did we do that? We recorded it in 2 days, mixed it in three, and we were done.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Wow.
We did the whole album in two days.
Cool.
And then another half a day maybe for, or day for Dave's vocals, and or day and a half, or two and a half, 2 days to mix. And that was it.
Did you guys at that time like try to get drums and bass together, like real tracks and guitars, or did you like just play together to get the drums and then go back and layer everything?
No, one of the reasons I wanted to record with Albini was because I'd recorded with him before with somebody else in his old studio in Chicago, which was in his house, where the drums were in the basement, where the Pixies and all those guys recorded. The drums were in the basement. The control room was in the attic. And I'd done a record there with him for somebody else. And then I, when I got into Flogging Molly, I said, I'm going to call Albini, see if we can make a record with him. And like, what do you want? Well, first of all, I mean, I liked the way he recorded. And I knew he had the engineering ability and technique to record the band at once. Seven people. His studio, it was his new studio, but only the B room was done. The A room wasn't done yet. So we basically recorded the whole band. Everything, maybe added a guitar track. The vocals were done. Lead vocals were done separately. A couple other tracks. But it was pretty much, that's the band playing in the room. The whole thing. And I knew he could take on seven people and make it work.
How much pressure do you feel as a drummer? I know my drummer, who's super good, Pat Shaughnessy, when we're in the studio, he's like this, there's this steadiness that like, it's just so awesome that he can do take after take after take and friggin' solid. And you are too. I know your drumming, I know your style, you're a powerhouse, you're awesome. Mentally, how does a person, do you feel pressure because you're the drummer?
Well, when I started, you certainly felt more pressure because when I started recording, there was no digital. And you're on tape, and so you're not dropping in on Pro Tools and places where you couldn't drop in on tape now. So you know what I mean by drop in, where, okay, you didn't quite get that. It used to be, there's the take for the drums, you start, and whatever length of that song, you got to get it from beginning to end. There might be a break in some songs where you could drop it on tape. So that kind of wraps your head around being prepared. And I think the more we rehearsed and worked on the songs before, the smoother it went, you know.
Right,
but
right.
But then at the point, you're just, you know, you're just playing to click track. You don't notice that it's there anymore. And
really?
Yeah, I never really. Once you play with it for, you know, you warm up and you start playing after 20 minutes, I'm like, it's there, but it's
so that's
more
amazing.
Internalized than evident.
Huh.
And then
when you record a whole track top to bottom, I think it shows. You can hear it. You can hear that energy, right? Like, I feel that some of those, like, 90s rock records, like your guys', is like, it feels so alive. Live, and right. not live, but alive. And that's a beautiful thing to get on tape or whatever.
Right. Well, that's the thing I wanted. Well, you know, Albini recorded to tape Swagger, and we recorded Drunken Lullabies to Swagger, to a tape. And one of the things about using him was, it was capturing the energy of the band that presented at live shows, which we didn't, at least I didn't feel that it was going to get captured coming out of the gate by tracking that band. And the one thing that I always thought was, if you're going to put out a first record, try to capture the energy of the band and sort of the esprit de corps of the whole thing versus trying to make a perfect sounding record.
Right.
I wanted it to feel like something that wasn't happening, even maybe less now, is that you feel like you're in the room with somebody, right? I wanted the person listening to feel like, oh, I'm in the room with them. I can, and there's room reverb, and there's all this stuff going on, and you hear the energy of the thing and the mistakes and everything else. I'm like, so what? Because the songs stood up above everything else, regardless of the recording technique or anything else, or performances that were great or not so great. It didn't matter.
Have you ever worked with the opposite kind of producer where it's like they are particular about like perfect recordings, or have you chosen, you would never choose that?
I mean, I don't choose or not choose. It's if the phone rings and they want to usually.
If you answer it, that's you choosing. Like if you say hello.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know what? Okay, so that's something else to learn, right? Yeah, and I've worked with.
Now there's an airplane.
Hello, airplane. And so, I've worked with producers who are more perfect like that. Who like they'll line up the every single kick drum part on Pro Tools and everything else. Which is fine. It's just a different way of doing it.
Yeah, and I think the average listener like me probably wouldn't really notice anyways.
Right.
Like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So there's an art to deciding when is enough with that stuff, right? Wouldn't you think? It's all part of the art of recording.
I think it's even when you're composing, you're writing songs or you're recording, you can have an endless canvas and it doesn't make for the best song or recording.
Yeah, it's almost good to have a deadline, I think.
Deadline, and you can limit yourself. Say, look, I'm only going to do this with this many tracks on tape. I mean, the most creative stuff came out of guys using 4 tracks, then 8 tracks. I mean, and look at, the technology advancements. It hasn't made the music better. It's given you more choices, but it doesn't mean that you're making better records.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think.
That's true. I think there's just an inherent truth to what you said. I mean, that's not even being subjective. I think that's just true.
Yeah, I think sometimes you get the best stuff when you limit the canvas, whether you're painting or you're writing a song and saying, look, I'm going to use these colors. I'm going to have an acoustic guitar, a bass, and a kick and a snare. There's no symbol. Like if you just
arbitrarily.
You just arbitrarily like say this is the canvas and see what happens versus you can do anything. You got Ableton Live. You got all these technological things that you can do that you can use. Get any sound and do anything you want. Algorithms to determine what chord is best for the next, after this chord or, the shape of the melody. You don't have to really do anything anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like it to me, you know. To my ears, it's boring.
Yeah.
I get bored easily with it.
You are you bored right now? You're not bored yet with this interview?
No, because I love watching the trains go by. No.
All right, let's move on to our
Los Angeles does have a metro rail system.
Now we know.
It's fantastic.
And it has an airport, apparently.
Yeah, exactly.
And it has a fly.
Yeah.
A singular one fly. Your drumming style. You said that you developed that because of the band that you were sort of... I mean, I'm, of course, paraphrasing, but your style is very... Oh, a race car. Your style is very unique and, in my opinion, is a defining characteristic of that band, Flogging Molly. I think when someone hears the band, they hear you, in my opinion. So, did you have to sort of make up or redirect how you approached playing drums in that arrangement with those kinds of players?
I did in the beginning. I changed the stick I was using when I at the time when I joined the band. I was studying with a guy named Ed Shaughnessy.
Oh, was he on The Tonight Show?
He was the Tonight Show drummer for years.
Oh, I know him. I mean, I know of him.
Yeah, he's a fantastic teacher.
Wait, did you say he was your teacher?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And before him, I got to mention a guy, Clarence Johnston, who's an old Boston guy who moved out to the West Coast bop era. And before I studied with Ed, I studied for 3 years with Clarence. And Clarence was the guy who straightened out my posture, my technique, all the bebop stuff, all like the independence. I mean, that was fantastic. And then I started doing some big band stuff with Ed. And Ed Shaughnessy is also a great Latin player, or was. He's passed away now, but most people don't know that. But he was really good. Yeah, he was a great Latin player.
Was he a nice guy, too?
He's a really sweet guy. Great stories. Really nice guy. And we used to sit there and read the Tonight Show charts and play them down like it was so much fun to get
serious?
That under your belt. Yeah,
you played that chart with that man who played that.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Oh man, that in itself.
Thank you, Shannon.
You're welcome. I'm really floored by that. I love that.
He was a great influence. And when I had the thumb surgery and my right thumb doesn't. It still has a titanium plate in it. But he's the one who said that when you get your surgery, get the stick, get your thumb could be shaped at any angle. Have it put to the angle how you hold the stick. And so that's what I did. And when you record that record with Albini and you're in the studio, he said, put the stick between your index finger and your middle finger instead of doing this. So I played like that.
Mm-hmm.
Which you can't see, but anyhow, between the index and the middle finger, I played the first record like that on my right hand because my thumb was in a splint and it was still recovering from the
incredible
surgery. So, and he's also the guy that said, I'm playing this kind of stuff and with this band, and it's up tempo, and there's a lot of like that that train style groove and right, and he's like. And he goes, well, what stick are you using? And I hadn't really thought about that. And I told him, and I remember what it was. And he goes, maybe you want to use a larger size stick and let the stick do the work. And so I went back to a stick that I was using in high school, the very first Vic First stick he ever made, the SD1. And I used that, and I've been using it ever since. It was a little bit longer, a little bit thicker. It was rock maple. It was a little bit lighter. But it allowed me to let the stick do the work and not fatigue for what I was doing. So, like, he was...
It's a light, sort of lighter touch than normally it would be?
I hit pretty hard, but it doesn't feel like it to me. I mean, I'm trying to let the sticks do most of the work, mm-hmm. right? Accent when I need to accent. But the style, back to that, the question was... developed from the necessity of coming up with something that fit with the Irish sort of influence and that Irish drum and the baron and imitating those sounds on the clicks, using rim clicks or, you know, driving it on the floor tom, you know, those sorts of things that you hear a baron do, the Irish drum, and trying to imitate that.
Yeah. Do you still play Yamahas?
Yeah.
There's a thing you did Do they endorse you?
Yeah, okay, for a long time.
So I watched a photo shoot you did with them with an interview, and you said something really cool in there. You said one of the drums you played was like dropping a pebble in a still pond, and the ripples go out. That's a beautiful image, because even non-drummers, I can hear what you're talking about.
Yeah, some drums just have a nice sound like that, and I think I was referring in that interview to these drums that I was using that Yamaha had made called the Phoenix drums, and they had such a nice sound to them just out of the box, where you hit that drum and you get that audio and visual imagery of that. It just decays nicely, you know, over time.
Naturally, like just
on
its own.
Yeah, on its own, which was nice, you know.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Speaking of Yamahas, I know that you chose a Yamaha. Well, do you mind telling that story again about why you played Yamaha drums?
Oh, no. When I was very young, until I was 9 years old, my father raced motorcycles, and he did a thing called flat track racing, amongst other types, but that was his primary racing. And that flat track was big in the late 60s up to probably the mid 70s, late 70s. It was big. It was there's always a race on Sunday somewhere around the country, and there was a national, there's still national events, but it's not nearly as popular as it used to be. There was a film made by Bruce Brown called On Any Sunday, which is a very famous documentary about motorcycle racing that was produced and by Steve McQueen, who also was a star in it.
Oh, very handsome fella. Those blue
eyes. It's a great, now it's a great period piece, but that's the kind of racing my dad did, because they focus on flat track, and it's basically on a horse track. So
is that when they go, they turn and their knees are like 1 inch from the track?
Well, that's more road racing. These guys, I still have my dad's motorcycle, but it was a Yamaha, and he didn't have brakes on it back then. And you slow down by letting the back end come around the dirt, the horse tracks, half miles and miles, ovals.
Oh.
So they just slide. It's like Speedway, but it's not into the different bikes than Speedway. And you just straight, only left turns, and the back end comes around, and you have a steel shoe on your left foot. So your foot's down there on the ground, so your foot can slide too.
The foot down racing, yes. Okay.
So it's just that one foot, and then the rest of it just sliding. And the back end comes around, and it straightens out. And but he raced Yamaha, and he liked Yamaha motorcycles, and I always remember him at the shop, you know, dealing with the Yamaha stuff. And when I went to get my first drum set, I mean, I saw Yamaha, and I'm like, I mean, I knew Ludwig because I had a Ludwig kit before that, but the Yamahas were nice, and I'm like, all right, it was good enough for my dad, it's good enough for me.
Yep. Beautiful.
So it had nothing to do with music other than, you know, what my dad raced.
Yep. When my parents were going through a divorce and I was 12 years old, I think my father felt bad, and he bought me a Yamaha Mini Enduro 60cc bike.
Yeah, those are great.
I still dream about the joy I had on that thing.
They're great. Right?
I was never a crazy driver. It was more like puttering, because once I broke my foot on it, and I never wore a helmet, like in the 70s or whatever it was. You know what I mean? How stupid were we?
Helmets, seat belts for kids, car seats. What are you talking about? There was a lawn chair in the back of the van, and you just held on and hoped for the best. I'm like, okay.
So, yeah, I love the Yamahas. I remember the gear pattern was four down, right?
Yeah.
Gear patterns on bikes. So, it's a beautiful thing. Do you ever ride a motorcycle?
When I can. I don't have one, and I haven't had one in a while.
Yeah, they're dangerous. Like,
It's sketchier, I think, than I'd like it to be out here. My dad would never ride on the road, even back then. He would only go out on the track or to test stuff, because he said it wouldn't ride on the road. It was too dangerous. People don't pay attention or watch you. But when he was riding, he didn't have to have a motorcycle license either.
Yeah.
He just got on and rode.
No kidding. That's sweet. Now, what about Los Angeles right now? The motorcycle riders in between the lanes, right?
Well, lane splitting, yeah. Yeah, they've been doing that for years. All they did was codify it, and so now that's legal. And they tend to do it between the HOV lane and the next lane over.
What's the HOV lane?
It's like the...
hang on very tight.
Yeah. No, it's the carpool lane.
HOV. What it's in the world could HOV... What could HOV and carpool have in common?
I don't know what it says.
You know, we'll put that in the notes, Shannon. Can we look do some research? Because I'm sure people around this country are going to need to know what HOV stands for.
Yeah, because it's just a carpool lane, but that's where they tend to lane split. They can lane split anywhere, but that's where they tend to lane split.
So dangerous. Is it or is it not? Like, just from the lane changing.
I mean, I've done it out here.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, and it's scarier when you first start doing it. And you always have somebody who's does something silly like pull over because they don't want you to lane split, which is kind of ridiculous.
Oh, you mean they block you?
Yeah, they try to block you.
Do you think that's something my brother would ever do?
Block me?
Yeah.
Angry guy?
I hope not. I don't think he's a lane blocking bastard. No, he's not. He's one of the good bastards.
Yeah, I don't think he would do that. Look, people get motorcycles because they're better on gas, they're better on the environment, and you don't have to sit around this traffic. So why begrudge them that? If they're going to take their life into their own hands, you know, give them a break.
At least give them a break. Don't block them in their effort to take their life into their own hands.
I had people pull over on me a couple of times to try to keep me from going through. whatever.
Do you remember what kind of car they were driving?
No.
Usually a fancy car.
I left like a dent in it, though.
Good. You should. Did you punch it when you were driving by?
No. I had my steel toe boots on it. I gave it a nice kick.
There you go. They deserve it.
Let them know.
Yeah. Don't do that again.
Not okay.
Jerk off. Yeah, right. Okay.
Oh.
Oh, high occupancy vehicles. Isn't that such a like a bureaucratic thing to just say? What was wrong with carpooling? High occupancy vehicles. Oh, sound. It's almost even.
Well, I suppose they're including buses that are allowed to use those and every other sort of like
you'd
people
have to say
movers
carpool,
and stuff.
Carpool, bus pool, lane. Like you'd have to. They got the buses would get confused. They don't know if they could go there.
Who knows?
Whatever. I'm going to write a letter to the governor. Okay.
You better hurry. He's going to be out soon.
I'll hurry. It's probably because of that. Okay. So just two more questions, and I appreciate your time today. You
sure.
know that. But they're really long questions. No, I'm just
okay.
kidding. I teach students at State University of New York at Fredonia in the music industry program.
Fredonia?
Yeah. Thank you for pronouncing it, because most people probably wouldn't know. I said Fredonia. You're at Fredonia.
Oh, okay.
It's Fredonia. Fredonia.
Yeah,
yeah,
Fredonia.
It's about 50 miles west of Buffalo. They have a really, really well-known music program, music
okay.
industry program. So my students ask me sometimes a very good question. They're mm-hmm. like, why are we going to college if we want to be in the music industry? I know you went to Ohio State. How does your college, please don't make all my students drop out of college when you answer this, but how did your college career, why are you happy that you have it? Or I guess be honest, are you happy you have a college degree?
Yes. The backstory on it is because where I grew up on the west side of Columbus, the musicians that I saw were all playing in cover bands, not going where they wanted their careers to go, and were quite frustrated with their situation. They were frustrated with, you get sort of trapped in that environment, right? Like you're in that cycle of being on the west side of Columbus, and it's, people weren't getting out of there, right? And, the one thing I knew that I wanted to learn more about was music. I didn't like that the people that I saw around me could play some things, but were pretty limited. And I just wanted to learn more about music, not knowing that I would end up relying on it later, whether I was studying with Clarence or Ed Shaughnessy or studying music theory and understanding Bartok's tone clusters and and 12-tone
serialism.
Oh,
there's a name for the episode. Bartok clone clusters? What did you say?
The clone. That's even better. I think Bartok would like that better. Tone clusters.
Oh.
Not necessarily chords and key areas.
I thought you meant like Bartok, like what we would talk about when we're in a bar.
No, I'm talking about B-A-R-T-O-K, the Hungarian.
Oh, of course. Bartok
fellow
cone
Hungarian.
Cluster. Wait, what was it?
clone tussles.
Clone tossers.
Who made this clone? Why is he holding on to me like that? No, tone clusters. Anyhow, it's just something in... It's just a way that he composed and interpreted music. Anyhow, the point being is that all that... Somebody asked me that the other night, and they said, "What? How's this, you know, I don't want to learn." I said, I didn't really want to learn or not learn. I just wanted to absorb it, just to be the sponge. Because what happens is, if you go into a situation where you're playing music with other people, and your well is shallow... You've got nothing to draw on, right? It's like if there are songs that I played with and recorded where I would do this thing on... there'd be a song, say, in 3-4, right? In a triple meter, like a waltz, right? One, ch, ch, one, ch, right? One, two, three, one, two, three, right?
Yes.
I play the bass drum on 1, the hi-hat on 2, and not play the hi-hat on 3. So boom, ch, boom, ch, boom, ch, boom, ch. The snap is where it's a rest. Where did that come from? Like, why would I do that? When usually you don't do that sort of thing. Because it was from a piece called The Drum Also Waltzes by Max Roach, who is a fantastic drummer. So, like, that's the well
so
that you draw upon.
You have,
if you have that kind of stuff and you pull it in and go, oh, okay. And then somebody said to me, how did you do that stuff on that song with Floggy Molly with the floor toms? You're doing all this cross-sticking. You know, one stick's going over the other, but it's making a certain kind of sound in a certain sequence. And I said, well, I said, that's from Saul Goodman's timpani method that I used when I was at Ohio
State. High five on that one. Do you know that stuff? Really?
Because that stuff, to me, is like, that's the well. And it's how you use it. Because everything else becomes boring. If you're just imitating what you hear, it's hard to invent. But if you can hear stuff and then draw on this well of stuff that juxtapositioning things like bebop or a classical timpani method against, you know, something that wouldn't make sense in a rock song. It's like, but it does, and you're just using a technique that you learned or something else. I mean, that's when things get interesting, whether you're you know, positioning music culturally one against the other, or, you know, putting styles against each other, as in Damon has done, you know,
with his new project, right? Yeah.
Yeah, with reinterpreting, you know, what these 80s pop songs could sound like in another way. It's that's when it gets interesting, because at the end of the day, in Western music, you're dealing with a limited vocabulary that most people have heard. One of my jazz teachers always used to tell me is, every great jazz song's probably been written. It's just what you're doing with it, you know? And, you know, everybody's probably intentionally or inadvertently covered just about every combination of melody and chord that you can do. It's now, to me, it becomes, how is it presented, right? How are you presenting the drums? How is that coming across? And I think it's finding your voice on the instrument, and you can't find your voice on the instrument until you have to start to know yourself. And then that starts to come through, and then you have something to draw on to create with, right? That's where that's where I talk about having that the well, and the well doesn't, you always dig. It never stops. It's not like, oh, I went to college and now I got this well of information, now I can just go out and play. It doesn't really ever stop. You know, the stuff that you keep listening to going, oh, whoa, that's, you know, and then you're like, how did that get from there to there? And I'm going to try that on the drums and see if I can do that. And I mean, there's still stuff that I hear that I chart out that I physically can't play. But I know that if I it sounds great, but I'm trying to get my body to do it, right?
Yeah.
Like different, like, oh, you can put that clave part on a hi-hat, that bam, 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 and mix it with something else and a different thing on the top, you know? And I'm like, okay, I just got to figure out how to get my body to do that, but there's something to it. Like, I can hear it, and I can program it, and I go, oh, that sounds cool. Then you get your body to do it, right? So that's where you're, like, going, mixing things up and saying, oh, that's interesting, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's worthwhile. To me, that's what makes it worthwhile. I mean, well, I never wanted to be an idiot musician. That was the whole point. There are plenty of those around, you know?
Yeah. That space is taken, right?
You know, and even if it didn't mean anything, you know, it meant something to me. I wasn't trying to prove anything to anybody else, but I just wanted to know, because I like to learn, and I like to learn about that stuff. You know, I like to, you know, why did Debussy start adding those sevenths and ninths and elevenths and thirteenths, and how did it get to sound like that? You know, and people always talk about, like, you know, great punk shows. To me, are great rock shows, or, you know, like the premiere of The Rite of Spring in Paris in 1913, when the Parisians tried to burn down the thing because they heard Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. That's punk to me. That's like, you're setting somebody's ears on fire. I mean, like, they lost their minds. It was so aggressive. They're used to a guy like Debussy and that kind of stuff, and then you come along with Stravinsky, he's going, doom, 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 doom. It's like that primal thing. It's like, to me, that's like, okay, that guy was on to something, right? That kind of stuff is amazing to me, right?
Yeah.
Like, you look like the history of it, and then you have something to go,
context.
Okay. Yeah, you guys have some of the context of, like, yeah, you know, that first time you hear something and it wakes you up, you're like, wow, okay, you know.
one more topic, and it might be just more of an observation. You're from Columbus, Ohio, right? Grew
yes,
up there.
Yeah.
I see in you a thing that I love about people. You have a Midwestern goodness and strength, like just your character. You have really good, I can just tell, not even knowing you, you have great character, and that's a strong foundation. Do you feel like, do you agree with that? Like, are your roots important to you?
Yeah, I never think about it in terms of, I guess I notice it, people say it more out here about like Midwest or Ohio or whatever, like having that foundation. But to me, it's more of my family. You know, when my father died and then my grandfathers became very significant influences on me, and it was always like, you know, it was always about hard work and integrity. My grandfather used to get mad at me and say, do it right or don't do it at all. Just, you know what I mean? And I'm not going to let you not do it right. So it's like, you know, it's okay to work hard. And, you know, I can remember one race in particular with my father, and it stuck out in my mind. And it was a motocross race, you know, with the jumps and the left turns to right turns. And his motorcycle, it's called when the spark plug fouled out, which means that it wasn't sparking. So he had to get a new spark plug. And my brother, and I think I must have been 7, and my brother was maybe 6. And I don't even think my baby sister was born. And my mom had her American Motorcycle Association mechanics license so she could go in and out of the pits. She got it so she could help my dad, mm-hmm. right? Because he was what was calling it independent. So he's on the other side of the track. His motorcycle stalls. Everybody's still riding around. So they've already lapped him once. The guy in the lead has lapped him twice, right? My mom, he's waving at my mom to bring a spark plug. She says, boys, don't move. We're standing there on the side of the track. She runs back, gets a spark plug, runs the other side of the track. He puts a spark plug in. Now, most people, like, your race is done for the day. But when I saw my dad, he gets back on the motorcycle. Not only did he get back on the motorcycle, he rode like he was out of his mind. Not only did he ride like he was out of his mind, he passed everybody up twice. And on the last lap, he went from 3rd to 2nd, passed the guy in the air. And the guy, he didn't win, but he got 2nd. And the whole point was that I can remember, like, the announcer and the adulation he got for coming in 2nd, because he didn't quit. It wasn't about, it's about what he did mm-hmm. to get to there versus the guy who won.
Right.
Which was like, that was amazing to me. And that's like one of those lessons you look back and go, oh.
There it is. You're like,
there it is.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
right there. It's, you know, it's your, the most influential people in your life, mm-hmm. you know, for most of your life are your parents. And you see your father doing that, and you're like, oh. I got something to live up to. mm-hmm. You know, that's the way you do it.
Well, I think you've done a fine job of living up to that.
Thank you.
And in my mind, you're not in 2nd place. You're in 1st place.
It's okay if I, you know, wherever you are.
Yeah,
you know?
You are. And so the only note I'm going to suggest to our listeners when they hear this is they might want to purchase some noise-canceling headphones, right? Because this was a really good interview, and they got to hear every moment of it. Right, George?
Yeah, listen to the trains, the race car, the sirens, the airplane.
The lady walking by saying, what did she say, Maggie? Or so, yeah.
I didn't even hear it.
We enjoyed all of it. All right, George, thank
Thanks,
you for
Allison.
Being here.
Yeah,
talk to you soon, okay,
yeah,
buddy?
Yeah, all right. Thank you.
About you, but I learned a lot this week. I learned that HOV means high occupancy vehicle. I learned that splitting the lanes is legal in Los Angeles, but splitting your pants is not. I learned that quite possibly my friends and I accidentally imported a fly from Buffalo to California. And I learned that my brother Damon has great taste in friends. Thank you to George for spending a fantastic afternoon with us. It's always so great when the people you look up to in music turn out to be among the nicest people you meet. As always, thank you all for listening. Please send us your questions and your comments to thegreatunsung@gmail.com. If you would be so kind as to share this episode and ask your friends to subscribe, we would be super grateful. Okay, and that just about does it for us. Thanks for listening, and until next time, this is Allison Pipitone signing off for The Great Unsung.